Okay, this is take two on the intro. Good evening and welcome. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement, the manifesto of the student activist movement, Students for a Democratic Society. The document was drafted by Tom Hayden, an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, and launched a decade of student protest and mass action for a more democratic society. We're thrilled to have the Tom Hayden here to discuss the statement and its relevance in today's student-led democracy movements around the world. To introduce Mr. Hayden, we are delighted to have with us Noam Chomsky.
Come right up.
Following our speaker's remarks, we will open the floor for Q&A. Please line up behind the mics in the aisle to ask your questions. And we also have several of Tom Hayden's books available over here on the stage that he will sign and sell at the end of the event. Before we get started, I wanted to thank the co-sponsors, Boston Review, MIT Department of Political Science, and the Center for International Studies at MIT. Please visit Boston Review's website at bostonreview.net for supplemental material on Port Huron, including an essay by Mr. Hayden. In addition, I'd like to announce a couple of events that you may find interesting, including this Friday when we will look at the Arab Spring and its impact on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And on May 7th, James Galbraith will be here for a book talk on inequality and instability. He will discuss the state of the world economy leading up to the Great Crisis. Now, please join me in welcoming Noam Chomsky.
Thanks. Someday I'll learn which side of the street Wang Auditorium is on, and I'll get somewhere on time, but not yet, only 57 years. When Tom's Port Huron Statement was released in mid-1962, it wasn't just a breath of fresh air. It was more like a blast of fresh air. It quickly played a major role in galvanizing the student movements that were beginning to poke their heads through the sound here and there around the country. One of the major ones was a couple of years before in Greensboro, North Carolina, when black students sat in on lunch counters, promptly arrested, kept coming back. That set off the freedom rides, which Tom was very much involved in, a formation of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SDS, a number of others, a little bit later, the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. And the Port Huron Statement was more or less the unifying document that very eloquently captured the goals, the hopes, the sometimes illusions, the expectations of the student movement, which over the decade simply civilized the country in a remarkable fashion before it self-destructed at the end of the decade in ways that also carry some lessons. Actually, MIT wasn't involved at the beginning. This was a very quiet, apathetic campus. There was a lot of faculty activity, but almost no student activity. That changed. By the latter part of the decade, MIT became one of the most activist campuses in the country. This is due to the remarkable work of a small group of undergraduates, many of them still involved in very significant activity. That had a lasting effect on the Institute, and I think a very welcome one. Well, before Tom talks, let me say a couple of words about what the world looked like in 1962. That's well to keep in mind. 1962 happens to be a very significant year in world affairs. In fact, a couple of months after the Port Huron statement was released, October 1962, came what has been properly called the most dangerous moment in human history. That's the phrase of historian Arthur Schlesinger, who was close confidant of President Kennedy's and official memoirist of the Kennedy administration. He's referring to the Cuban Missile Crisis, October 62. During that crisis, there were two occasions on which the world came very close to what would a nuclear war, which in President Eisenhower's words would have destroyed the Northern Hemisphere, barely escaped. Plenty of recurrences since, and some are possibly imminent today. It hasn't ended. There's a background. On next October, I'm sure the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis will be commemorated. It'll be interesting to see how much of the background is presented. So the immediate background was a major campaign of terror launched against Cuba by the Kennedy administration. Its centerpiece was Operation Mongoose, run by Edward Lansdale, who had plenty of experience in terrorism, sometimes called counter-terror. If you look closely, they're approximately identical. Even the descriptions in Army manuals are almost identical. This was the top priority. The top priority of the Kennedy administration was to overthrow the Castro regime. No effort was to be spared in doing so. I'm virtually quoting Robert Kennedy, who was the president's brother, who was put in charge of the campaign. It was a major campaign of terror. I won't run through the details. You can find them. But what was critical, and of course the terror went on long, it was picked up again right after the crisis and went on, in fact, many ways up to the present. Kennedy's role, Robert Kennedy's role, according to Schlesinger in his biography, was to bring the terrors of the earth to Cuba. Again, top priority of the government. It came very close to nuclear war, barely avoided it. Shortly after, in 1963, Edward Lansdale was given the Distinguished Service Medal for his achievements in terrorizing Cuba and bringing the world to the brink of nuclear war. You look back further, there were reasons for this. Partly the reason was the almost hysterical reaction to the failure in Washington, to the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion. But a deeper reason was that Cuba was, in fact, a major threat to the United States. And it was explained by Arthur Schlesinger, who was Kennedy's main Latin American advisor. He summarized the reports of a Latin American mission to the incoming president. He said, the danger is the spread of the Castro idea of taking matters into your own hands, which might have considerable appeal to others in the region who are suffering from the same kind of repression and violence and starvation that the people of Cuba were suffering under the U.S.-backed dictatorship. As was put in internal documents at the time, a fundamental problem is Cuba's successful defiance of U.S. policies going back 150 years, that is, to the Monroe Doctrine, which announced the U.S. plan to dominate the hemisphere. Couldn't be implemented at the time. The British were too strong, but it was recognized that over time, British power would decline, U.S. Power would increase, and the U.S. would achieve what the Founding Fathers took as their major foreign policy goal, to take over Cuba. Now, that happened in 1898. Here it's called the liberation of Cuba. In fact, it was the prevention of Cuba's liberation from Spain, which they had practically achieved. and it remained a virtual colony until actual liberation in January 59, and the U.S. Reaction began very quickly, bombing a couple of months later, formal decision by the Eisenhower administration to overthrow the regime, secret at that time. In March 1960, Kennedy administration took over. It was escalated it sharply up to the level of virtual nuclear war. The Lansdale mission was designed so that in October 1962, it would lead to uprising and subversion, which would be able to overthrow the government along with direct U.S. Military intervention. October 62, most dangerous moment in human history. Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time, conceded later that if he was a Cuban, he would have expected invasion, given what was happening. Well, that's Cuba. Cuba was what was called, it's called in internal documents, a virus that might spread contagion to others. The virus is the spread of the idea of taking matters into your own hands. Contagion is that others may be infected by it. That terminology is borrowed from a gentleman who's speaking down the street at the moment, Henry Kissinger, when he was actually referring to the Allende regime, which he and his boss, Richard Nixon, were about to overthrow on what's called in Latin America the first 9/11. 9/11, 1973, by any rational measure, much worse than the second 9/11, what we call 9/11, but out of history, like everything that's not supposed to belong there. Well, that's what do you do when you have a virus that's going to spread contagion? Well, you destroy the virus and you inoculate the potential victims. And that's exactly what was done. They didn't quite succeed in destroying Cuba, but have kept it in a stranglehold ever since, with years of terror, with a crushing embargo, which is opposed by the entire world. The UN can only round up Israel and Marshall Islands or somebody. But it continues, and there's a really important point. You cannot permit successful defiance. That's what I've sometimes called the Mafia principle, one of the leading principles of world affairs all over the place. And it's understandable. If you're the godfather and you own your territory for the U.S., the world, and some small storekeeper somewhere that doesn't pay protection money, which you don't care about, I mean, you don't even notice the money, but you can't let them get away with it. That kind of successful defiance is quite dangerous, might spread contagion. Others could get the idea you'd be in real trouble. So you don't just send your goons in to get the money, you beat them to a pulp and make an example. So leading theme of world affairs, you find it over and over again. One place you find it is another event that took place in 1962, which we are not commemorating now, which tells you a lot about the mood of the country. In 1962, Kennedy launched the direct invasion of South Vietnam. That led pretty soon to the worst atrocity in the post-World War II period. Millions of people killed in Vietnam, many millions elsewhere, four countries destroyed. Kennedy in November 1961, early 62, sent the U.S. Air Force to start bombing South Vietnamese targets, authorized napalm, crucially authorized chemical warfare for defoliation and crop destruction, began the programs that drove ultimately millions of peasants into what amounted to concentration camps or urban slums so that they could be protected against the insurgents who the government knew very well that they were supporting. Chemical warfare has had particularly lethal effects up to the present. Saigon hospitals are full of aborted fetuses, severely deformed babies. The main component of the chemical warfare was dioxin, which is severe poison carcinogen also has genetic effects. This is a third generation still showing up. The first book on the effects of Agent Orange, as it was called, on the South Vietnamese, has just appeared by Fred Wilcox, A Study of the Victims, his first one, and it's not going to be a bestseller, given the kind of society we live in and the kind of culture we're part of. It should be. Of course, there's no compensation for the victims. There is a debate about Vietnam, the Vietnam War. There's a debate between what are called the hawks and the doves. The hawks say, if we'd fought harder, we could have won. The doves say, it was a lost cause, it wasn't worth it. It's approximately the same debate that took place in the Soviet Union right before it collapsed about Afghanistan, or for that matter, on the German general staff after Stalingrad. Was the two-front war a mistake, or could we have made it somehow? Interestingly, the dovish side is expressed pretty well by President Carter. In 1977, he was asked, do we owe some compensation to the Vietnamese? And he said, we owe them no debt because the destruction was mutual. No comment. Take a look. Interestingly, the population felt differently. At that time, around 70% of the population described the war as fundamentally wrong and immoral, not a mistake, a view that you simply could not find anywhere in articulate opinion. You can take a look and check. Well, that's the Indochina War. Incidentally, the reason for the Indochina War was very similar to the attack on Cuba. If you look back at internal records, we're lucky to be in a very free country. There's tremendous access to internal documents, declassified documents. It was the same concern back in the early 50s. The U.S. didn't care that much about Indochina, but it was regarded as a virus that might spread contagion. Independent nationalism and Vietnam, Vietnam particularly, might infect other countries in the region, maybe going as far as Indonesia, which did matter, that had rich resources, and that might go all the way to Japan, which Asia historian John Dower, who's here, one of the leading Asia historians, described as the super domino. If Indonesia fell to independence, Japan might decide to accommodate to an independent Southeast Asia, becoming its commercial and industrial center in a region separated from U.S. control. That would have meant that the United States would have lost the Pacific phase of World War II, which was fought to prevent that outcome. That was Japan's new order. And in the early 1950s, U.S. planners were not prepared to contemplate losing World War II. So destroy the virus, and in this case the virus was pretty well destroyed, and establish a brutal military dictatorships everywhere in the region, in Thailand, Burma, and Philippines, and crucially Indonesia. And once that was done, the virus was contained. In fact, McGeorge Bundy, the Harvard dean, who was the national security advisor for Kennedy and Johnson, in later years, in retrospect, he concluded that the U.S. should have called off the war in 1965 when a military coup took place in Indonesia, killed hundreds of thousands of people, secured the country, opened it up to Western exploitation, no more contagion. They didn't think about it at the time. Well, that's Vietnam. The same was done with Cuba. Cuba was severely attacked, and a plague of repression spread through the region like nothing in the history of Latin America. It began with a major military coup in 1964 in Brazil, actually planned by the Kennedy administration, though implemented right after the assassination. Brazil's an important country. That was the first of the sort of neo-Nazi style national security states, and then it spread over the hemisphere. Pinochet in Chile was one of them. Argentina was the worst. That was Reagan's favorite. Spread to Central America in the 1980s with atrocities you know about. Well, that's how, in both of those cases, the problem of the virus and contagion was dealt with. There was a contributing factor in Latin America, another critically important event that took place in also in October 1962. That's Vatican II, Second Vatican Council, which was initiated by Pope John Paul XXIII, which, well, in the words of one of the leading historians of Christianity, Hans Küng, was an epoch-making and irreversible event. Irreversible, I'm not so sure, but epoch-making, definitely. It was the first time in 1,600 years that the Church returned to the Gospels. The message of Vatican II was that the Church should adopt the radical pacifist message of the Gospels, which is there if anybody bothers to read it, not just mouth the words, and adopt what was called the preferential option for the poor. And it was particularly influential in Latin America. Priests, this is 1962, priests, same time as the Missile Crisis, same month, in fact, priests, nuns, lay people went out to the peasantry, organized people in what were called base communities, read the Gospels, thought about it, asked how they could deal with the problems of their own lives, take power into their own hands. The U.S. wasn't having any of that, as you can imagine, nor was the Vatican, incidentally, after Pope John XXIII died. That's another factor that set off this massive wave of repression. That one came to an end in 19. There are plenty of religious martyrs, Archbishop of El Salvador, priests, nuns, you know, long list of them. It ended in 1989, right at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, when six leading Latin American intellectuals, Jesuit priests, had their brains blown out at the Jesuit University in El Salvador. The action was carried out by an elite Salvadoran battalion armed and trained by the United States, a long train of bloody victims in its wake. It had just returned from some training, updating of their skills at the at John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And we know that it was acting on the direct orders of the high command. That was leaked in Spain about 2 years ago, and the document was actually published in the newspapers. I don't think it's ever been mentioned in the United States. The high command, of course, had very close contact with the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. military. And that essentially terminated it, and but more or less, not quite. There's more that goes on. And there's no real question about who is responsible for all of this, because the perpetrators have identified themselves. The School of the Americas, which trains Latin American officers, have a horrible record. If you take a look at its what they call their talking points, the points by which they advertise themselves, one of them is that the U.S. Army helped defeat liberation theology, the heresy that was set in motion by Vatican II. So that was an extra reason to go after the virus and block the spread of contagion. Well, that's the world in, not a bad picture of the world in 1962, along with the fact that nobody paid any attention to any of this. And in fact, that we're not commemorating the 50th anniversary of the worst atrocity of the post-World War II period, because almost nobody knew about it, Kennedy's invasion of South Vietnam. It's not that information wasn't there. Like if you read the back pages of the New York Times, you could find a little item saying that a third of the bombing missions are being carried out by the U.S. Air Force and a couple of other things like that. So it was there, but, kind of like a yawn. Who cared? Well, the the effect of the 60s was to change a lot of this, but not to change it enough. There have been major changes. In fact, the fact that we're meeting here is a perfectly good illustration of that. In 1962 at MIT, you couldn't possibly have had a meeting like this. It was inconceivable. Now you can have it. It's an indication of a lot of things that have happened. And if we think about the past and the present, still a long way to go. Thanks.
Thank you all for coming tonight. I've never had the privilege of speaking with Noam Chomsky on the same platform, as I recall. He has a better memory than I do, so I might have forgotten something. But I remember, as a young man, questing to understand more about the intellectual failures of our policy. I went to his house, which may be still his same house, I don't know. It was about 1967, and he was typing in a bedroom. I believe I don't know anybody else who has done this. You don't know what a typewriter is, probably, but it's a similar thing to a computer, and it's on the bed, and he's on a chair to take care of his back, and he's typing. And I think he was typing his famous, notorious, epical article on the failure of the intellectuals in Vietnam in 1967. It's been that long. I have seen him here and there since, but that was our first conversation. And I have to tell you, because he's sort of a homeboy here in this neighborhood, you may take him for granted, but he is also a global treasure and a witness to suffering and the morbidity of much of our world. So I want to thank him for coming and making that introduction. It's probably my nature. I'm fairly gloomy as an Irish American. I believe in the absurd nature of reality. Something in me is instinctually oriented to fighting the good fight against the bullies. It could be that primitive, that basic. I want to compliment Noam's lecture or introduction, his overview, by saying something more about the nature of the fight, past, present, and future. Because I'm a combative person. I am also a historian of social movements. I try to keep my distance and understand what's going on. Sometimes it gets mixed up. A few years ago, I took some MIT students with me and Harvard students to Miami to the Free Trade Zone of the Americas meeting, which was supposed to make Miami the center of corporate globalization for the hemisphere. And I told my students that they were to participate in the confrontation in the streets as observers, and I wanted them to interview at least 100 people in the course of the week so we could do what we didn't achieve in the early 1960s, which was on-the-spot interviews of people taking direct action around a cause. So they did that, and in the course of the several days they were there, none of them had any prior background. I think one of the Harvard students had some background in activism, but most of them got arrested while backing up from the Miami-Dade police, saying something, shouting some slogan like, "We are retreating," which didn't do any good. They were then thrown on the ground, pepper sprayed in the eyes with the eyes held open. And it was quite bizarre because then their parents began to get word as they called for bail. And I was up all night wondering what to do. And the IOP over at Harvard was getting calls from above saying, what the hell is Tom Hayden doing in Miami with these students being arrested? Who paid for this? And the answer was, Harvard paid for this. And they all got out, and the whole purpose of it was to give a direct account, an eyewitness account of whatever was about to happen in Miami. And I tried to explain to them, I thought that they would get an enrichment of their educational experience that you could never get in a classroom or by reading a book. And it would be the nearest that I could possibly introduce them to what it was like in the 1960s. And it was. They came back. They faced a barrage of questions. Why did you do it? What were the ethical questions? You know, why did you tarnish the name of the institution by being down there? And on and on and on. But they gave quite fantastic eyewitness reports to students. So I have a soft spot in my heart for the students of MIT who were there and Harvard who were there. And they did have an experience quite like the early 60s. And that's what I want to dwell on tonight. Noam talked about the negative side of 1962. And I want you to remember in my comments, I'll try to be extensive, but more in an outline form. It's hard for anybody here who missed it to conceivably remember the period 1960 to 62. First of all, nobody said, oh, we're in the 60s. They had a vague idea that the 50s were supposed to be a period of apathy, when in fact, of course, there was Little Rock, there was the Montgomery School boycott, there was the Beat Generation. There were these precursors to what was about to happen. But it is true that students were not organized, did not aspire to power over or even a voice in any decisions at the universities. It was a novel and subversive idea to form a student political party to run for office in student government elections. It was against the rules for those elected student leaders to take positions on the civil rights movement in the South to support idea of boycotting northern chains like Kresge's and Woolworth's in support of the Southern sit-in movement. And we couldn't vote. We could be, guys could be drafted, but nobody could vote, of course. So in a very real sense, we internalized our powerlessness and described it as apathy. And it left a kind of yearning or anxiety that I think was just looking for an outlet. And these prior events in the Deep South and in San Francisco gave rise in the course of the years to the idea that students should take direct action and should participate in trying to improve society for the better in a very general way to make it more democratic. And I was a student editor at Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, and I remember in about 61, they were trying to recruit me. Those of you who aren't radicals will appreciate this. I'm talking to you. You should make it difficult for them to recruit you. You should ask a lot of questions. I just wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a storyteller. I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. I wanted to get away from the Midwest, I suppose. And I was not engaged. And I had to cover these stories. And they kept trying to convince me to join this crazy group, Students for a Democratic Society. And I thought my mission was, as it is now, to try to observe and tell stories. It hadn't occurred to me that you could be engaged and also be observant in a different way, as my MIT students tried to be back in Miami, as I described. So I came to the 1960 Democratic Convention covering it. I wrote a story about the Berkeley student uprising in 1960. I was condemned by the dean of students back in Ann Arbor who called me in and said that my writing was incendiary. If you looked at it today, and you can probably find it online, everything is there. It was really milquetoast. It was about as tepid a description, but it was a description of students taking stands, students finding a voice. That's what it was. He said, this, Tommy, this leads to Stalin and Hitler. So I should have realized at the moment that the first instinct of any establishment is to overreact. They never begin to try to accept your viewpoint and ratify it and legitimize it. It's this total overreaction, which, of course, sent me into a alienated state, and I had the power of ink. I was the editor of the newspaper. So we went after the dean of women. We went after the fraternities. It all started with that little overreaction by the administrator. And I was invited to go see for myself what the South was like. By the way, I have a 12-year-old African-American son. I just took him and his mom through Mississippi, Birmingham, Selma, Memphis. We were at the Martin Luther King anniversary of his killing just last week with Jesse Jackson. G's Bend, where the elderly people are weaving in a weaver's collective. We met with an 83-year-old illiterate man who may be the next Picasso, named Thornton Dial, whose art is spectacular. So I'm trying now to speed up time so that my son can get an eyewitness sense of what this all was about. But at the time, I was asked to go to Fayette County, Tennessee, as a student editor to deliver food to sharecroppers who had been kicked out of their homes for trying to vote. And that's where I met the Southern students in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And that's where I met Southern violence and Southern sheriffs and chains and whips and clubs and lynch mobs. And we just got out of town driving 100 miles an hour on dirt roads. And that was my awakening. And from there, I followed the trail of love and passion into the South, and I lived there for a couple of years. This has background to how I was looking at conditions in 1960, 61, 62. I was in a jail after a freedom ride when I was asked by SDS, I was now a field secretary, writing about this movement. And they asked me to draft a position paper because they needed not a manifesto, but some kind of vision statement, you would call it in today's terminology, and the vision thing. And so I started drafting notes on what the vision should be, and it became this Port Huron statement, this big, bulky document that I urge you to read for yourselves. It found its way out of jail into New York libraries, into campus meetings. It was a very collective endeavor. But the idea was to create, and we were all 20 to 22 years old, the idea was to create a vision for our generation because we had this sense, and I think, Noam, it's quite related to the wind that was blowing through the Vatican. There was a spirit in the Kennedy administration and in Vatican II that somehow, I won't say it was supernatural or spiritual, but I can't say it was material. I've never been able to pin it down. But I feel that we were vessels or instruments of a feeling that was abroad in the world that did not come from us. I mean, how, after all, could I or anyone at age 22 write a $27,000 word founding statement of an organization? It's impossible. But it happened. People read it. They say, well, how did you write this? They say, I don't know how we wrote this. But we drafted it and had a meeting of about 60 people in Ann Arbor, moved over to a camp given to us by the UAW and that auto workers, and we met there. That's why it's called Port Huron. By the way, I don't think that's good branding, if you want to use modern terminology, because no one has visited Port Huron, so they wouldn't want to revisit it, unless you're Michael Moore, who has who has filmed, he has filmed people there, but no one else I know has visited lately. We were at Port Huron because the UAW had a labor center, a camp, and at the last moment we were very lucky to obtain it, and we met for 5 days in small groups. We read, digested, argued over, and had a quasi-religious experience rewriting and ratifying this whole document, which we sent out as a living document to our generation in hopes that it would speak to people of our generation. And I think this emphasis on 1962 is extremely important because on the one hand, I hope that we can be forgiven for our omissions. There was no women's liberation movement. The environmental movement had not materialized. There was a consciousness of nuclear testing and the bomb. The Cuban Missile Crisis was 3 months later. The list of things that were around the corner is very long. But I would argue, and this is I think the chief point I want to make, is that the core message that was understood at Port Huron and delivered by our authors was a lasting message that is well worth reexamining today for the Occupy movement or for all kinds of single issue movements. I do not believe that, as some do, that it should there should be a new Port Huron statement. I'm not nostalgic or interested in the resurrection of things of that sort. I just have this feeling that there comes a time, there are certain moments that manifest in an outcry by people, like Allen Ginsberg's Howl, an outcry that speaks to everybody else. And it's not an individual act. It's an outcry that somehow a few people have the good fortune to be able to articulate and pass on. The core message of the document was participatory democracy. Noam has written on some occasions of the author of this concept, as far as I can search for the authorship. No ideas have single authors, but it seems to be John Dewey. I think so. So John Dewey was actually an elder of the elder organization of SDS before my time, but this was an old social democratic institution. And John Dewey's idea was that democracy, voting was not enough, but that participation was essential in all spheres of life. The family was too patriarchal. The workplace was too corporate controlled. Neighborhoods had rights against developers. Foreign policy shouldn't be the domain of remote enclaves of experts. More democracy was good, essentially. And it was, he probably was in the tradition of Henry David Thoreau, who at an earlier time, when there was even less of a franchise, had argued, vote not with a mere strip of paper, but with your whole life, meaning put your body on the line as a democratic act, as a participatory act, that the measure of a democracy should be whether it's hollow and token or whether it's robust, fulsome, and participatory. And it can be measured. It's a flexible concept. It allows you to be, say, an anarchist for participatory democracy or a libertarian for participatory democracy or a feminist for participatory democracy. It is a concept that embodies a method and a goal that is more inclusive, I would argue, than other more ideological concepts that people in progressive movements or the left have identified themselves with. But again and again, the resilience of this concept keeps coming back. You see it in the September 17th initial principles of Occupy Wall Street. The first primary principle is for a direct and transparent participatory democracy. You see it in the students in Tunisia. You see it in the students in Egypt calling for democracy. And it's clear that while the meaning of democracy in those places is yet to be fully defined, if it ever is, it was participatory democracy as both a means and an end, that it took direct action, it took the occupation of Tahrir Square, it took the full participation of the excluded to begin to move the heavy weight of the military dictatorship and the institutions in those countries. So in that sense, it's about direct action, it's about voting, it's about protecting voting rights from people who would whittle them away, but it's also about a voice for workers at the factory, it's about a voice for neighbors, it's about a voice for citizens in foreign policy, it's about a voice for students as these decisions are made about tuition and the cost of higher education. That's the concept. It's a big concept. It's not definable merely as small groups seeking consensus together, although that too has been part of the tradition from the Quakers to the early sit-ins. I want to say also that it seems to me it's alive in the dreamers today. I just finished teaching a class at UCLA, and the Dream Act students, I'm sure you have some here, these young people who are here as undocumented residents of our country, have made decisions, as many did in the 60s, to come out of the closet, to come out of their shadows and repression, and face their fears and face their families and say, I'm an MIT student, I'm a UCLA student, I live in this country, deport me if you must, but recognize who I am. That is the spirit of participatory democracy on an individual and group level that I'm talking about when I discuss SNCC and the early SDS. It's alive and it comes alive, and I think it always will, because institutions, whatever their purpose, and they can have very good purposes, always become deficient, because a politician cannot represent everybody. That's why you have red power, black power, brown power, yellow power, queer power, union power, student power, because everybody wants empowerment of some kind of self-determination or self-representation in the process. And the only way to get there is through a process that allows people a fair opportunity to participate in the decisions that affect their lives. That's the idea. And I think it will grow beyond belief. You can already see it, and if you're at MIT, you're probably in the vanguard of it. In the age of new technology, it should be possible for people to participate in ways that I cannot imagine. I'm not here with utopian thoughts about what the internet permits. Suffice it to say that when we had meetings, we did so by calling people on telephones. That's an obsolete idea. I never use telephones. Or by writing them letters saying, I'll see you in Washington at the meeting, handwritten letters on yellow pads with stamps. So you could actually say we created a bigger movement without the internet. The 60s was a global movement, there's no question. So it doesn't take the internet to create an interconnected uprising around the world or around your town, but it certainly, in my judgment, does not hurt in the least. It makes so much possible. Interactive participation, downloading of information, the real use of the Freedom of Information Act, referendums. If they can survey you in the detail that they do, if you are like microbes to be studied for the purpose of selling you something, whether it's a candidate or a product, That same technology can be used to hold people with power on a very short leash of accountability. That's all I'm saying. So I think this is a concept that will only grow in relevance. I'm not here, in other words, to praise a relic, but or resurrect a relic. It's never really died. Now, one of the elements here, I need to tell you this in a story form, so you further understand the differences with the present moment. We occupied lunch counters, we occupied segregated trains, we occupied segregated buses. Yeah, occupations came before us in the 30s, factories, they'll come after. The Redwoods were occupied. So occupation as a tactic is a way that is familiar to partisans on the left or in radical movements and social movements. And it's a way of making your voice heard, make your presence known, becoming visible, and above all, getting traction, getting leverage by seizing part of an institution, at least temporarily. The purpose with the sit-ins and the freedom rides, the purpose of the sit-ins was to block access to lunch counters and restaurants that segregated in hopes that the repression that came down would cause constitutional problems for the state, image problems in American foreign policy, and above all, a rise of sympathy, empathy, and solidarity from students of our generation, our parents, unions, religious groups, and so on. So it was a tactic that was meant to bring alive a greater participation on all levels in solidarity and support with the movement. And this the idea that I learned from going to Mississippi early and getting my head beat in and covering funerals of people who were killed for trying to vote was there was an actual plan that historians seem to miss. The plan was not to protest for the moral purpose or the purpose of redeeming the Southern Church or reviving the tradition of nonviolence. The purpose was on a group, among a group starting with 15 and it grew to several hundred and then to maybe a little more than that, was to take a blood oath to go into areas of the South and put your body on the line in order to break a system that had held since the obstruction of the ending of Reconstruction in 1876 and the introduction of Jim Crow and terror in the American South. Why do I say that? At the time, we still had the seniority system we do now, but because the Southern whites were very clever and cunning, because they had been on the losing side and were very concerned about preserving what they had utilized seniority to take the chairmanships of all the committees of Congress. Military was Stennis, Eastland was constitutional rights, plantation owner. And they sat in senatorial and congressional districts, typically in which the majority of people or a vast number of people were black people who were not allowed to vote, and their exclusion was reinforced by local police. And that instilled heroism in a few and terrorism in the many and apathy as the outcome until the SNCC came along and they made what I would call a generational decision that I heard Obama saying in 2008 over and over, and I think he got this from Bob Moses and some of the early SNCC people, that for each generation, including yours, there a decision has to be made that's very personal about whether you're willing to settle for what your parents left you, whether that was enough, and whether they've set something up for you to inherit that you're satisfied with and can enjoy for the rest of your life and maybe your family's life and your friends' lives, or whether it is intolerable, whether it's because your parents didn't fight hard enough or they fought all they could and they just could not push any harder. All these students knew that Jim Crow was their future, and that was a kind of death. And so they took an oath to die if necessary, try to avoid it, to die if necessary, in order to break it. And it was a gamble. The idea of going to try to register somebody weighed heavily on you if you knew that that person could die, or you could be killed, or you could go back to Boston and leave behind people at the mercy of the Klan. A lot of people called this a martyr's complex, and I suppose it was, but that's only a way to say people had really had all they could take of living this life. Without that, nothing, I guarantee you, nothing would have happened. That was the catalyst. And I was very caught up in this because I was a student like many of you, many in the country today, who had general purposes, general ideals, but it had never crossed my mind to put my life at stake for something I believed in. And I didn't know then, and I don't know now, whether I'm willing to do that. The older I get, the luckier I am, the less I'm likely to want to end it before I find out how it turns out. But at the time, this was a very powerful emotional bind that people were put in. And you can dismiss it as say it caused people to feel guilt and so on, but that's not really it. If you've been around people who believe in something strongly enough that they're willing, if necessary, to die for it, I bet those are people that you would like to be like. Those are people you would fall in love with. That's how it was. SDS was an ancillary of SNCC. SDS was the boycott support organization. I was the pamphleteer. I spoke on campuses. I tried to recruit students to go south. And all my life, I think northern students should always keep going south, whether it's Venezuela or Cuba or Mississippi. The South is the frontier of the battle. I don't know why that is. It's just they go to Nicaragua, they go to all these places, and they come back with a changed view. Maybe a Chomskyan view, I don't know, but a changed view of the way the world works. So that's what happened, and that's what we tried to articulate. Now, I want to argue that we might have been successful. Noam spoke of illusions. I think we had illusions, or maybe another way to think of it is the future is unexpected no matter how smart you are. It's just unexpected. Who could imagine then what happened? So don't ever think that you already know what's going to happen. In 62, we thought that through the direct action campaign, we would force the Democratic Party to abandon the Southern racist wing. We would liberalize or free the liberals of the Democratic Party. And through a combination of the movement and the institutional liberals, we would effect a majority coalition that could realign American politics, elect a president or hold a president accountable, and a congressional majority. We were talking about winning the whole thing, and then finding out whether that's where power was or not. We didn't know. If you look at the Port Huron statement, we have a suspicion that there's a higher level above the politicians. But we were following John Dewey, which is learn by doing. We didn't start with a theory of where power was. We started by direct action to confront power and think that it would be revealed to us what our possibilities were. But it was a very positive expectation alongside the morbidity of the oath that some might die, but millions could be liberated in this process. It would take this realignment. There was no such thing as rejection of electoral politics, even though we couldn't vote, blacks couldn't be registered, because we thought that by direct action, it would be like the Archimedean tool. It would crack open the political system, and people would be able to utilize the political system as a result of the direct action. So it was this outside-inside strategy, and we were the catalytic force, if I can just put it that simply. And I think that that we were on a trajectory towards success. Number one, the moment was right for the country to embrace voting rights for blacks in the South. Number two, the farm workers were getting organized in the Southwest. SNCC organizers and SDS organizers were going out where I live. Number three, the peace movement was waking up after the Cuban Missile Crisis to the horrific nature of the nuclear arms race and the Cold War. Rachel Carson's book just came out talking about the shock of radiation and pesticides. The women's movement was starting to emerge. All in this period, 60, 63, maybe 64. So everything that we thought was possible was coming true with somewhat to our surprise and shock. We were, again, John Dewey is helpful here. We're very experimental and always trying to evaluate what just happened after we came back from an action, because we never knew what would exactly happen. But things were happening. What thwarted us was the unexpected, and it came, I think, in three or four forms that we can discuss. And I don't know if Noam and I agree on this, but I think the murder of John Kennedy was a big factor. We never had a professor who taught the role of assassinations in understanding history. We just didn't think of the president might be killed for whatever reason. And this would be a big problem for our strategy of political realignment, to say the least, if there were forces on the loose that would kill the people you elected or kill them as they were changing policy. Kennedy was changing policy from against the March on Washington to for the March on Washington, against he called SNCC sons of bitches because they were so militant and pressing him, to supporting voter registration, pumping in foundation money, making a conscious decision in hopes that the Black South would realign, register, and vote Democratic, because he was going to lose one by one the White South. All of this was happening, and the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which was left out, which happened shortly after Port Huron. Just to put it in context, how important Kennedy was to us, we wouldn't have gone to take these risks in Mississippi if we thought Kennedy was going to save us. No, I'm not saying that. But I am saying when we finished this document, Al Haber and I drove to Washington, and we met with U.S. senators, and we went to the White House to meet with Arthur Schlesinger and had a fine old discussion with him, taking him through the points of our document in case his generation of liberals had missed what we had to say. And he promised to take it to the president. We said, mission accomplished, let's go back to the barricades. But we had there's a strange period here in which all things seem to be possible, and I don't know if that's an illusion, but it's an unusual and rare illusion to experience. So the death of Kennedy, and by that I mean to encompass all the other assassinations of the 60s, continually decapitated leaders of our country, leaders of movements, in ways that were unpredictable, and really prevented, I think, the consolidation of a progressive bloc in the country. That's one big thing. Two was the issue of Vietnam. And here we may have a disagreement. I have only read what Noam has to say. But I don't believe Kennedy would have escalated the Vietnam War by sending 500,000 troops, combat troops, to Vietnam up the ladder of escalation. I agree with Ellsberg, who says he probably would not have. I recognize that this is self-serving and wish-fulfilling, but I think it's also true that he would have drawn the line before sending in tens of thousands of combat troops. We'll never know. But the point is, after Kennedy's death, Johnson ran for president on a program of denying seating in Mississippi to the blacks that we organized to come to the convention, and on a promise never to send young American boys to Southeast Asia for combat. While at the same time, the orders for combat, according to Ellsberg, were being written in the National Security Council. So we had never had the experience of presidents being killed, nor the experience of presidents lying to us on simple matters like whether they would draft you and send you into combat. This was a totally shocking and disorienting experience. And with Vietnam, we had 100,000 troops in 1965, and it went up to 500,000. We had the draft, we had draft resistance, we had the rise of an anti-war movement that became very radical in tactics and in vision. And it was aimed at the liberal failure, the liberal default, because we really couldn't blame the Republicans for starting the Vietnam War. We could blame them for being collaborators or go-alongs. We could agree that Goldwater would have been worse. But nevertheless, it was the Democratic Party that was drafting us, sending us into combat. It was the Democratic Party that was escalating the war with the support of all liberal Democrats in Congress, except for two brave senators. Those are the cards we were dealt. We were 24 years old. That was it. So that ended the idea of realigning the country around domestic priorities of racism and anti-poverty. At this point, 64, SNCC with thousands of you all was in Mississippi paying the blood debt and also breaking the system in Mississippi. And I was in Newark believing I'd be there for the rest of my life, knocking on doors, organizing poor people for an all-out assault on poverty from Appalachia to Mississippi to Oakland to Los Angeles, to Chicago. We had 150 community organizers from SDS working in the North in parallel to the South, not knowing that Vietnam was coming. We had devoted our lives to this task, and with Vietnam, many of us stayed. The issues remained, but it was clearly impossible to deal with poverty and race domestically in the midst of a war that was escalating. You could feel the life of reforms being sucked out of your lungs. It became a bitter time where you had to take a stand on the draft, on the war, and you had to pay the consequences, and you knew you were in for a long, high-stakes and bitter battle. So Vietnam derailed the project. A side point here, a third point, it related to this that we never knew was the role of the CIA. And I'm not into conspiracy theories, but I study them carefully because you never know. You just never know. So in 64, Wright Patman is a member of Congress. He holds a hearing on some slightly unrelated subjects, and it comes out that the CIA has been doing, in 67, he's been doing domestic spying. Domestic, CIA, what is it doing with domestic? And it turned out, going back, that they had been very involved for a very long time. This is the reason that we could not shift from the Cold War to domestic priorities, because the CIA operationally funded and ran the International Affairs Department of the AFL-CIO, which we were in coalition with around jobs and civil rights and justice. The 1963 march would not have happened without them. But their international department was helping stop communism around the world in the name of protecting workers. We did not know this. I don't think anybody on the domestic side knew it. They also were running the International Affairs Department of the U.S. National Student Association, which was supporting civil rights in the South, but their international operation was involved in the Cold War. point, I could go into detail, but the point is, it was structurally impossible to realign the country away from the Cold War if the people you were working with were a front for the CIA and didn't know it or didn't tell you. So there was a blockage. There was just a blockage in the system that we didn't learn about for several years later. And that's the reason that the tragedy happened. Reuther, for example, the great UAW leader who funded SDS, he funded the Economic Research Project, he funded SNCC, he funded the farm workers. He was tightly aligned with Johnson and the Democratic Party, and in a turf battle with the rest of the AFL-CIO, his top lieutenant, Millie Jeffrey, was the mother of one of our founders, Sharon Jeffrey. And we saw in 64 that he would not support the civil rights plank. And then in 65, Reuther supported the escalation of the Vietnam War. That was it. He was the last hope for us of the liberals that we had believed in. He changed later. He died in an accidental death, a tragic death. But by the time he changed, it was all too late. The possibilities had disappeared, basically. The fourth and last reason that I think the project failed is because of sectarianism, ideological sectarianism. I'll be very brief on this. SDS was not a Marxist document, not an anarchist document. It was an anti-communist document. It was rooted in the participatory democratic populist traditions. It was very homegrown. I think Noam mentioned in his talks about Dewey that Dewey was an unusual American who seemed to be a homegrown radical who wasn't an inheritor particularly of the ideological baggage or traditions of the left. And I always thought of myself that way. And it's not that we were opposed to these traditions. We tried to learn from them, study them, and incorporate the lessons. In one section of the Port Huron Statement, the collective document, I don't know whose language it was, it said, we want to work with both liberals and socialists. Liberals because they're practical and relevant, and socialists because they have a long-range critique of the system. But we didn't identify exactly with either. It was a more inclusive concept. But long about 67, with the escalation of the war, and the only apparent explanation for the war was imperialism, and all of the theories of the left seemed to be proven on the battlefield of Vietnam, and the Cubans were saying this, and so on, people started to think that the Port Huron Statement was too reformist. I was out of the organization by this point, but had I been there, I would have said, yes, that's true. It was always reformist. The question for us was token reform, substantive reform, radical reform, which? Revolution was an ambiguity. It was just an ambiguity. If we could get radical reform, that would seem to be the achievement of what the people on the other side of the door were demanding when we knocked on doors and they said, all my life I've wanted to vote. I want to vote before I die, and so on. So the Port Huron generation and document were denounced as not radical enough. In fact, reformism was considered not treason or selling out, but closely akin. Like you had to be really out of your mind to be in favor of reform. And then what was introduced, because of the gravity of the situation, and the seeming failure of the American tradition to solve the problem of Vietnam or racism were various forms of Marxism or anarchism that divided into three or four factions that fought constantly with each other. Not that they had no substantive critique, but it was curious that the organization divided into these factions. And dissolved itself in 1969 as a triumph by closing the doors of the SDS office in Chicago and throwing away the pig, throwing away the key and announcing we off the pig. This was at a moment when 1 million people were demonstrating in the moratorium against the Vietnam War. 20 million people were about to demonstrate at the first Earth Day. Kent State was 4 months around the corner, the largest, and Jackson State, the largest student strike in the history of the United States and the largest there ever will be among students as far as I can predict anything. But the organization had taken an ideological position that was so far removed from the mainstream of students and Americans in general, it was an oddity. The country was just calling for democratic revolution or reform, and SDS was underground or engaged in factional disputes and utterly and totally isolated. 6 years after the founding, I will dwell on this the rest of my life with remorse and with reflection as well. I'm not trying to be judgmental. I'm trying to tell you what I think happened to this document. Now, one last observation or set of observations about Occupy. If you read the Port Huron Statement, you will find, I'm Talmudic about this, I know everything in it, I'm searching for who exactly wrote that sentence, so forgive me, but on about page 27, you will find the statement that 1% of Americans control 80% of the wealth. So I want to say we accomplished much. We left a job behind for the succeeding generations. It's a fact. At the time, we said 1% controls 80% of the wealth, and we added, with a little research, that as a matter of fact, it had remained 1%, owning 80%, since the 1920s, despite the New Deal and all of the reforms of the New Deal period. It had never changed. Just like in the 60s, much has changed. We have a black president, much more equality for all kinds of people, much greater access, participation. You get the feeling that if measured by diversity, a revolution has occurred. But what if diversity isn't the only measure? What if the question of the ownership and control of wealth is also a measure? And what if it remains the 1%? What has gone wrong? Where are we? Before I try to answer that question, I'm not sure I can. I promise to be more optimistic than Noam. So I'm going to list for you the things that he mentioned that we accomplished, lest you forget. Because in my theory, when you accomplish something, the other side becomes vociferous because they're the most threatened. Your side declines because they're happy with the achievement. The rest is fought out in the battlefield of memory. The establishment incorporates the reform. It becomes so every day that you can step on and not notice that people risked everything for it, such as the curbs for wheelchairs on the way to this event were achieved by disabled people following the tradition of women and SNCC and SDS taking their wheelchairs and their beaten bodies and sitting in buildings in Washington until the government was hammered into submission and they passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's a 60s achievement. Voting rights for Southern blacks and 18 to 21-year-olds, total of 26 million Americans enfranchised. The end of the Indochina Wars, the end of the compulsory military draft, the fall of two presidents, new at the time congressional checks on the imperial presidency, the War Powers Act, the CIA and the FBI, amnesty for 50,000 draft evaders and war evaders in Canada, normalized relations with Vietnam, the Freedom of Information Act, 1965, the Media Fairness Doctrine, late 60s, the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, which would not have happened without the 60s, toughest environmental reforms in American history, passed and signed by the government and President Nixon. I might just show you how my little theory works. It's called the Movements and Machiavellians theory. The Machiavellians take advantage and credit for what the movements accomplished. One simple example. It was Nixon that signed all the environmental legislation, stronger, not good legislation, but stronger than any legislation signed since. It's because of Earth Day. And Nixon, when the book by Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, came out, the Bible of environmentalism in the late 60s and 70s, Nixon wrote the blurb. He had said in his you're laughing, you need to laugh. It's got to be funny, this stuff, not just morbid. He in his State of the Union speech said words to the effect that it's now or never for the environment. He later said to an interviewer, the environmental issue didn't matter that much to him. But he said this. So the publishers of the Carson book, Silent Spring, said on the cover, the blurb, it's now or never, President Richard Nixon. That's how it works. So you might not notice your achievements because they're in the hands of others, unless you fight the battle of memory. That's the great battle at the beginning and end of all this. The public sector employees, like those people battling in Wisconsin, they won those rights in the mid-60s. The first collective bargaining rights for farm workers were won in California by the union started as a result of the early 60s. The reform of university curriculum, now, like it or not, you can read Noam Chomsky and not get kicked out of school. It used to be you'd have to go to the coffee shop to read Noam Chomsky. You can say, well, so what? Well, I have to tell you, at least make a list in your mind of achievements, failures, shortcomings. The list is very, very long. And I have a theory that progress moves in stages, and movements are eventually blocked. They turn on themselves. They come to an end. But they go on. The underlying current goes on like a river. And then people climb on into the stream, into the current, and start again, always quite by surprise, but they do. And that's why Occupy Wall Street came. I don't know if it went, but I was really pleased. I was at briefly at Logan Square. I was at a number of other events. And all I could say is that I didn't expect it coming, and I didn't expect to expect it, because you do not ever expect social movements. Except in general. Name one that anyone has ever predicted the night before, the week before, the month before. It's testimony to the fact that energy is kinetic. It's unpredictable. No matter how smart you are, you cannot comprehend or predict what's about to happen. It's an argument for taking your chances, taking risks, thinking of yourself as a factor that may start something and often may not. But without you, the evidence of history will be missing one possible component, or rather, you'll be on the shore over here and the stream will be rolling without you. I think that's a very important thing to realize. I mean, how could anybody in their right mind, you'd have to be not in your right mind, actually, call for a demonstration on September 17th on Wall Street with the slogan, bring your tents? What? That's what happened. It was time. I think the time has not changed, because the Wall Street crisis is still there. The scandal is still there. The politicians are institutionally incapable of engaging in the level of reform that might begin to meet the needs of the people who are suffering, just as was the case in the early 1930s. And the police cannot eliminate the conditions. They cannot eliminate the protests. They can only reconfigure the direction that the protests may go. There may be some problems. It seems to me, just to name one, and then I'll stop. I've always felt you have to have be visionary and pragmatic at the same time, and so you need to pick fights that focus the many against the few, where you think you've got a chance, and have a plan of action that starts with your direct action, but hope that the fight that you pick will reveal the larger issues that affect everybody. I don't believe in uniting the few against the many. I believe in uniting the many against the few. So there hasn't been a sustained campaign to attack Wall Street in my lifetime, and a 2 or 3 month campaign is not sufficient. I think that just as my dean of students back at the university 50 years ago was scared to death when I just wrote a little article about students on the rise, Wall Street is scared to death of this movement. I think that they always overreact. I think that's a tragedy, but keep that in mind. It would be a big mistake to think that they're invincible or unchangeable, or to think that just a handful of us can't do anything about it. If I were Van Jones, and I want to clarify that I'm not, and I want to clarify that this is only what I think. It's not anywhere near what is going to happen. I would go back to Wall Street with a plan, with a three-point set of radical reform demands that are achievable but not easily, achievable by local action, federal action. And I would sit in at the biggest bank at Wall Street that would accommodate me, and I would get arrested, and I would try to nail the demands on a tree, and then I would go to jail, and I'd say, I want a jury trial. And I would urge my supporters to come with me to jail and stay in jail and demand a trial by jury, and fill the jails. And if they force you to get out, go back. How many times? I just come from the trail of Dr. King and my old comrades in SNCC. How many times did they go to jail before the system broke? Each time they went to jail, they had no idea if they were coming back alive. They had no idea. Maybe this movement is too agnostic. They had faith. They had a messianic faith. They believed in the faith that had fortified their forebears. They knew that they were a part of something spiritual and larger that many other people had come and gone and died for in the past. Somehow, they had this energy to keep going back. You can't imagine what it's like to go back to Birmingham. Oh, my God. Wall Street is a soft touch. The NYPD, they don't match. They don't match the Birmingham police. They don't match Jim Clark or Bull Connor or people that would... I was interviewing Chuck McDew. He said, you know, these southern white people are crazy. They're totally crazy. These are the kind of people, I'm interviewing him 2 months ago. He said, these are the kind of people that if you get in their way, you picket in the street like these Wall Street demonstrators, they will run over you with their truck. And then they will back up to run over you to make sure you're dead. And sure enough, as he was giving this statement to me, this interview, that's what they're doing in Mississippi. Do you remember? Not 3 months ago, there were these crazy teenagers that ran over a black kid, and then they backed up into reverse and ran over him again. McDew didn't know this at the time. He just said, that's what these white people do in the South, and this is what you have to be prepared for. So taking on Wall Street, we've failed so far, but maybe it's because we haven't tried hard enough. I have to tell you, the mountain of Wall Street is not higher than the Stone Mountain of Georgia. It is not higher than the woods and tall forests of rural Mississippi. It is not higher than the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Tennessee. And it may be what we learned that is the most valuable lesson is that you may be winning while you've experienced the feeling that you're losing. I got ahead of my parents' generation. I thought they would never come around. I was completely surprised when they turned against Nixon and the war. I thought in my omnipotence that they should have done it 10 years earlier. But I don't get to control human behavior. I can only do what I do, take the stand I stand. But I wish that I had constantly paid more attention to trying to appeal to them instead of turning bitter and feeling that they had let us down, because they did let us down. That's part of the reason we were motivated. But you really can't win people to your cause if you just repeat that they're letting you down. You have to keep repeating that democracy requires them to pay attention, to read the facts, to give it another look, and eventually, somewhat miraculously, in some cases, they'll come around. And if I would be very surprised if a majority of Americans would not come around to support rational reform of Wall Street corruption and economic scandal if they saw lots of demonstrators in jail and appealing to the American people. It just seems that something like that may happen. It happened with the New Deal. Think about that. We think the New Deal was a set of laws that were passed to protect labor unions, establish Social Security, send a lot of intellectuals to interview small farmers in the South, all these great things, as if somebody had that plan. No. Roosevelt was a cautious person, a pragmatist. Remind you of anyone? It reminds me of somebody. And the left thought he was a sellout, and the right thought he was a communist. I don't know what his middle name was. Delano, but it wasn't Hussein. But they kept saying he's either a corporate fascist or he's a communist tool. And I think he was a pragmatic politician buffeted by the forces on all sides in the midst of a depression and a coming war, and you could never predict what he was going to do. But people who undertook organizing, community organizing, labor organizing, rural organizing, farm organizing, elderly organizing, healthcare organizing, kept shouting their demands and blocking entranceways and voting for politicians either in office or out of office. And out of this chemistry of confrontation and tumult and contestation and unpredictability came the New Deal as an outcome that nobody could have predicted at the beginning. That's what I think the future of Occupy looks like. Thanks very much, and I hope that I haven't taken too long. Thanks. While we're rearranging, I'd like to ask you a favor. I spend most of my daytime trying to end these wars. This just happens to be the Port Huron cycle. But it would be very nice if you want to be on my email list for ending the wars in, you name them. I started with Iraq. We got that done, but it seems to proliferate. For everyone you end, there's five. It's like a toxic swamp out there. It's a contagion. Exactly. I'd love to have your emails, and I won't sell them to any marketing firms or anyone? Yeah, you can have that. Thanks. Do you want us to sit down or answer questions? Okay.
I know it's getting late, so we are going to allow for 20 minutes of Q&A, and then we'll be ending this talk. Thank you. And no, please.
Who's going to call on the hands? I'm under an interrogation light here. I don't know if Noam can see everyone, but
we'll have Daniel from Hello? Boston Review.
All right. Where's Daniel?
Hello. Yeah, this is a question, Mr. Tom. You just said that, again, that the redistribution of wealth hasn't changed since back the 1930s. 1% still owns 80% of the wealth. And now, we have a political system that needs lots of money on both sides to get elected. And you have this same 1% that control the media. So how can you guarantee that the 99% is going to be represented when you need that much money to get elected? How can you guarantee that any politician elected through our system is actually going to be sympathetic to the 99%?
Well, I think the 1% is somewhat divided. There's a small number of the 1% who think that increasing employment increases demand, and that will reduce radical protest, put people to work, and so on. So they're more Keynesian in terms of economics.
So we have to wait for the 1% to change. I mean, there's
no. I mean, that's why the parties are different in their funding. They're not identical, and their base is different too. The Democratic Party is mainly. The anchor of the Democratic Party is the black community, the Latino community, the women, and the unions. And the liberals are harder to define. But then you add on some small business and so on. And you see a diversity of gender and race. And on the Republican side, you see basically white supremacy, people from the Confederacy and the Wild West wars against the Indians still dominating the party. So there are some differences, and it's just a matter of creating enough force to get them to compete about what to do about you. Some of them want to crush you, repress you. Others want to make a concession to see if things settle down. And we have no great control over that, but I think we're a factor. I wouldn't say we're more than a factor.
Thank you. I find it very interesting, your statement that SDS dissolved, at least in part, and maybe largely because of internal sectarianism.
No. Well, there were four reasons, but anyway.
Yeah, one of them. And I think you're factually right on that, but I wonder if there's a context there, and I want to briefly note the context and ask whether you would agree with it. I think SDS had really lost a lot of its power by the end of 1967. In the summer of 67, as I recall, Stokely and H. Rapp Brown started speaking a lot about black power. And almost overnight, on maybe 100 college campuses, the SNCC chapters, almost all of them closed, because the white students could not explain what black power was and why their chapters should endure. And I think, in a way, your close connection of SDS and SNCC in the earlier 60s and mid-60s became manifest here again. Once SNCC was weakened by the call for black power and the lack of comprehension of what it was, then SDS was as well weakened. And perhaps that sectarianism was a kind of consequence of that newfound impotence, namely, it just wasn't powerful enough to keep the steam going, and at that point, then, the internal factions came to the forefront. But had the steam kept going, perhaps it would not have fallen into that kind of sectarianism.
Well, I left out a very important thing in my excessively long speech, which was COINTEL programs, FBI infiltration, like nothing since the McCarthy period or the 1918 period against immigrants. We'll never know how big a factor that was, both in SNCC and in SDS and in the anti-war movement. It was phenomenal. And it continued even when SDS disappeared. But it's an interesting point. The history, as I understand it, is that we organized to change the Democratic Party or challenge them to seat the Mississippi delegation in 64. There was a lot of unity around that. It was one of the great grassroots movements in politics that should never be forgotten. Democratic Party rejected it in the same month that the bodies were found in Mississippi, August 64, and the Gulf of Tonkin incident, so-called, started the Vietnam War. Accident? Probably. Related? Inevitably. But what happened then is that Stokely, a dear friend of mine, the late Stokely Carmichael, he went to Alabama, where I just was, and he was organizing a similar project among poor blacks in Alabama, and they were going to contest the all-white Alabama political party, whose symbol was the cock. The cock is also the symbol of white people in South Carolina. I went to a baseball game at the university there recently, and everybody has T-shirts saying, "Go Cox." This is true. So the local people wanted an alternative symbol to the cock, and they chose the Black Panther. And so the Black Panther was supposed to be the symbol of a voter registration political empowerment drive in Lowndes County, which is an all black county in Alabama. And then a very different set of people, the Black Panther Party of Oakland, Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, these people saw that and were attracted to it, and then they announced that they were the Black Panther Party. And this was in the midst of unpredicted riots and rebellions in black communities that came as we escalated into Vietnam and left anti-poverty programs behind. So it's all related, but it's very complicated. And I don't think that SDS was deflated by it, but I think SDS was split over it, because to be as radical, to be John Brown kind of solidarity with the Panthers would obviously cut you off from white moderates on the campus. And people were divided about whether to do that, how to do that. So the group was weakened, and the Panthers were selling red books, Mao Zedong's red books, on the Berkeley campus for money. And so they helped introduce Mao Zedong thought and Kim Il-sung thought into everyday discourse in these radical groups. And off we went. I find it hard to believe the FBI accomplished all this. I think we brought much of it on ourselves. But it was because of the radicalization of the times and the people feeling that reform had completely failed and we were helpless.
Thank you.
Thank you. Noam should jump in here.
They can hear me anytime. You talk.
Hi. Could you say something about the role of the formal organization in movement organizing and participatory democracy in particular? These days, it seems like a lot of the contemporary movements like Occupy or the Arab Spring or Anonymous are more horizontally organized, lack any explicit leadership or membership cards or offices or anything like that. Is this a positive trend, or is there still a place for, say, a new SDS that would give more leadership, explicit leadership or unity of purpose to a movement?
That's why I said Van Jones won't take my advice. Well, this is not the first movement that disavowed leaders. To our shame and embarrassment, I mean, SNCC and early SDS were of the view that Martin Luther King wasn't radical or militant enough. And there was a lot of guffawing about the black preachers are trying to take over and they only come in and we're the shock troops, we're the ones getting killed, getting beaten. Well, he ended up being the one getting killed. And there was a lot of rethink at the time. But it is true that having a single leader is dangerous because of the threat of violence. It's impossible because of diversity, because you can never choose one person who represents a multiplicity of diverse backgrounds, and no one is willing to trust their movement to somebody who's not of their movement exactly. And we had our horizontals. The criticism I have of horizontal is sometimes, unfortunately, great decisions are made when you can't get consensus. It's an oddity, but you get stuck for hours, and And I want to add that before saying one of the worst decisions was the inability of SNCC to resolve what to do about the whites. They stayed up all night. I missed part of that meeting, but they decided on a one-person vote, so like 23 to 22, after 12 or 15 hours of discussion following weeks of prior discussion, to ask the whites to leave to go organize whites so that they could organize blacks from a more nationalist perspective. It was all very understandable, but the way it was handled was devastating to a lot of relationships and left people kind of immobilized because they had given their life to this project. And many of them even agreed. It may have been white SNCC people who cast the deciding votes to expel themselves. I don't know. It's a secret ballot. No notes were kept. I have fragmentary notes. So that was a terrible outcome of the struggle for consensus. They could have decided, since we don't have consensus, we're not going to decide. That's about it. But I think accountability and discussion and full participation is very important where lives are at stake. But for the passage of this document, how the hell do you think we voted on this? We used Robert's rules. We made them kind of a radical version of Robert's. Certain things were considered so important that they required complete consensus, like the values chapter. Other things were added, like we recognized that it was the International Geophysical Year. That was called either a widget or a gizmo, I forget. In other words, no discussion, any objection, that goes into the document. Nuclear power plants can give us renewable power in our cities. That had no debate. We didn't know what it meant. It was a widget. That went in. So it was a kind of participatory consensus process with voting just to help get us done because we had a goal. I don't know if Occupy had a goal. Our goal was to get the damn document finished in 5 or 6 days as best we could. And we finished it off by saying, we'll call this a living document, meaning it's subject to next generation's revisions because we can't possibly vote on everything in it and we don't even agree on everything in it. So it's a muddy area. But in general, I'm very anti-hierarchical. But I feel there has to be a word said in great empathy and appreciation for people who were leaders, who represented constituencies, and are forgotten for the sacrifices that they made. And they're totally indispensable. Whether they were political leaders or preachers, they were indispensable too. They were part of the hierarchical element of a mass movement that also had a more democratic participatory element as well. So on that, I can't help beyond that.
Thank you.
Folks, I'm afraid this is our last question today.
Oh, come on.
Hi, thanks for coming. Thanks both for coming. It was a pleasure listening to both of you talk. My question is, I could ask a lot of questions, but the question I want to ask is, what do you both think about the likelihood of an attack on Iran and what Good. The consequences of that will be, not only for the U.S., but for the Middle East region, and if there's anything we can do to lessen the likelihood of an attack happening.
Doctor?
They can hear me anytime. You answer.
No, he said both of you. I noticed he picked up my suggestion that Noam talk. No. Use both.
He wants to go second.
I don't care.
No,
I'll
I don't
go
care.
First or second.
I want to go,
order.
Not
Any
at
order.
All. I mean, I'll talk about it if you like, but I've given lots of talks about that around here. I mean, the thing you have to remember is we're already at war with Iran. The level of sanctions amounts to a blockade. A blockade's an act of war. That's not just my opinion. Gary Sick, the one of the leading American specialists on Iran has just written about it. So we're at war with Iran, and the question is, are they going to respond? Well, the Gulf is just laden with, like you said, battle groups, aircraft carriers, small Iranian ships, and so on. As the sanctions are tightened, as you kind of tighten the noose, it increases the possibility that some inadvertent act will take place, which will lead to war. Like, take the First World War. You know, it was a totally unexpected minor act which set off things which were waiting to explode. And many wars are like that. So we're increasing the risk that there will be a war. There are elements in it. Israel's unpredictable. You know, there are, apparently the intelligence and the military doesn't want to go to war. But there are elements in the leadership that do. Rather, they want the United States to go to war. You know, they don't want to do it. They want the United States to do it. Well, you know, you think about it a little. Even people here with our level of tactical sophistication could figure out a way to manufacture an incident in the Gulf. It wouldn't be that hard. And it could happen, or it could just happen by itself, or the Iranians might react to the tensions. It's also well to remember that the United States and Europe are almost totally isolated on this. Practically nobody else in the world supports the sanctions. Obviously, Russia and Iran don't support them. India has stated openly that they're going to disregard them. Turkey's increasing its trade with Iran. The most interesting, and Latin America, of course, but anywhere in the third world. I mean, the whole non-aligned world, which is most of the world, for years has been vigorously supporting Iran's right to enrich enrich uranium. The most interesting case is the Arab world. When you read the press, they tell you the Arabs support the United States on Iran. What that means is the Arab dictators support the United States on Iran. The hatred of democracy is so profound that it doesn't even, nobody even cares about the fact that the populations of the Arab world overwhelmingly think the threat that they face is the United States and Israel, and maybe 5% think Iran is a threat. They don't like Iran. You know, there's long conflicts going back to Persia and the Arabs, so a lot of dislike of Iran, but just don't think they're a threat. In fact, a considerable majority think that the region would be more secure if Iran had nuclear weapons to counter the real threat, the United States and Israel. Now, the first this has been going on for years. The first article referring to it's just appearing, and it's mistaken. It claims it's a result of the Arab Spring. It has nothing to do with the Arab Spring. The attitudes were the same, even stronger before the Arab Spring. This goes way back. But if you don't care at all what people think, which is the normal assumption, then who cares? The dictators support us, so on. It was pretty much the same on Libya. So the U.S. and Europe are quite isolated, Israel, of course. Israel would like to see the United States go to war. The Pentagon and intelligence plainly don't like the idea, and they think the outcome will be between bad and horrifying. But it's possible to imagine an incident, either contrived or accidental, that would tip the balance. I don't know if you can say anything more than that, frankly. At least I can't.
Well,
I mean, what can we do? We can try to put an end to this lunacy, you know.
Well, I would recommend people who are against a coming war, a possible war with Iran, have one simple thing to do, which is to get out on the street corners like the anti-war movement has done for 10 or 20 years and put up signs saying, no war with Iran or against Iran.
Can I add one thing?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Absolutely.
But there's one concrete thing that people can stand for. There's overwhelming support in the world, absolutely overwhelming, for a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. The support is so strong that the Obama administration had to formally say, yeah, we think it's a good idea too. But they added, not now, and not including Israel. Okay. Well, okay. So that kills. But there's something quite concrete that you can come up and stand for, a perfectly reasonable proposal. Let's move towards establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. Just moving in that direction would lessen the crisis, mitigate it, and if it could be implemented, it could perhaps end it. And that's a reformist proposal. You know, that's a simple one.
Deep.
But go ahead.
Good luck with that one. I think the reason to be on the street corners with placards is because there's so many people who have your question, what are we going to do? Is it going to happen? And there's a chill or that's been imposed on the potential peace movement or opposition movement, and because by its nature it's a threat that's elusive. You know, your best bet is to let your neighbors and friends know that at least you're against it, and have a good leaflet and have good educational materials to start the discussions. I say that because breaking the ice is the way it always begins. And also, this is the kind of war, if and when it happens, and I agree with Noam that the assassinations are all, and the embargo, all indications that there is a war, a siege plus killings, but it could be a much different war, and that's what we're talking about. It will happen if it happens one night like this, and you'll wake up disoriented and not knowing what exactly has happened, and it'll be difficult to mobilize, because if you sat now, you could have three or four scenarios of what's going to happen, from the most horrific to the least horrific, and people would be debating. And you know what these debates over tactics become. They're exhausting, especially when you don't know what you're talking about, because it hasn't happened. So preparing to do something and saying to yourselves, if this happens, we're going out on the streets of Boston in 12 hours demanding this, and we're going to announce it now, we're going to have placards up, we're going to have leaflets out, this is our opposition, it's coming, know that you're going to pay a price if it goes any farther, and start building a huge movement that's based on information and connectivity and coalitions, and be kind of actively waiting for this to happen. Do I think it will happen? I don't know. I think Noam's suggestion of an incident accords completely with my background experience. But I don't think that Obama wants it to happen for his reasons. And our generals don't want it to happen, so it's kind of an odd coalition here. One of the things that you can do, because it's an election year, is keep pointing out that the Republicans are worsening a very problematic presidential and national election campaign by using it to exploit and beat the drums for war. And say, which is true, it finally came out this week, but some, like Daily Cause and my website, have been saying it for 3 or 4 months, that Mr. Romney and Mr. Netanyahu are our partners. They are business partners from a firm called Boston Consulting. Find it, stand in front of it, say, has Netanyahu been here? Just anything to raise the awareness that these people are in business together historically. You can throw in Edelman if you want, and his $20 million to Gingrich. But Edelman owns newspapers in Israel that are promoting Netanyahu and war, right? So the Republicans, for their own electoral purposes, perfectly Machiavellian, fiendish purposes, are beating the drum and saying Obama's weak unless he supports an attack. And Obama's former advisor on this subject has left and written an article in Foreign Affairs saying, actually, Obama should start the war instead of Israel because it's easier for us to carry out. So Obama's looking around. Who exactly is on the side of avoiding war here, the Pentagon and
intelligence.
Where's the 99? Well, no, they're mixed up on this. I don't think you can say, unless we do our work, where they stand. They will be against it after it's been carried out and there are adverse consequences. They'll be for it if there's a miracle and it, quote, works, which is mainly a public relations game. I think it's much more likely to be on the horrific end. But they won't be against it until it's already well underway, unless we somehow play on that doubt and tell people, you are being manipulated. Look at the Israeli hawks are working with the Republican candidates, including the former Santorum, night and day to provoke us to get involved in another war that's dubious in its purpose, but we know that we cannot afford it. We don't have the blood, we don't have the tax money, and yet the way politics works, we could be pushed into either approving it or engaging in it, and the resistance to it will come after. That's what I hate about it compared to where we are with Pakistan, where you can see exactly which congressional members you've got to take out, change their minds, whatever you want to call it, how much it's costing, how public opinion has turned totally against it. It's kind of running on empty. We're supporting a nepotistic, completely corrupt government.
It's
a Humpty Dumpty. In Afghanistan.
Yeah.
What did I say? Yeah. Huh? That's same. No, it's
that's,
all.
That's
it's
another all. One.
If you want to end, if you want to end the drone attacks, I'm talking on because it's the last question. If you want to end the drone attacks, you've got to get a settlement in Afghanistan. You can't just be against drones because you don't like scary things in the sky. It's the drone attacks are trying to take out the people that we say we're supposed to ultimately negotiate with. Well, that's a hell of a negotiating strategy, to be killing as many of them as possible, hoping they come crawling to the table. It's nuts. But at least with that, I can see the strategy for getting out. It's 10 years. It's a disaster. It'll take another 5 years, I think. But I can see it going. But the problem with Iran is, it's like a heart attack, and where's the emergency room? It's going to hit us like a heart attack. Did I answer your question?
No, I was going to mention Glenn Gross's poem that's been met with utter silence.
The what?
Gunther Gross's.
Oh, well, that's up to the Germans.
My apologies for interrupting this exciting Q&A. We can continue the discussion, though, up front, but we will have to in the formal way, but please come down front. Tom will be signing and selling books. And thank you so much for our speakers. Thank you for coming.